Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Summer's Child by Lou Ann Rice, narrated by Anne Marie Gideon. Prologue. At the time, it was the biggest story in the state. Every newspaper covered it on the front page. Her face was as well known as the governor's, and much more beloved. The excitement in her blue eyes, the enormous smile, the shimmer, yes, that's what it was, the way she positively shimmered with life, radiated goodness. She looked like everyone's favorite sister, best friend, and girl next door, all rolled into one. The fact that she was pregnant when she disappeared gave the story an extra terrible jolt. When you looked at her photo, now you saw her joy, as if it were right there with her. You imagined how thrilled she was to be having a baby, and you knew that she would be a wonderful mother. Some people hide their feelings, keep them inside for no one to see. Not Mara. She'd never hidden anything. You just looked at her picture and knew. That smile and the brightness in her eyes left no doubt at all. She was right there, smiling into the camera with the same degree of love and presence that she brought to everything in her life. I love you. You know that, don't you? Take the picture so we can save it forever. Put it into the baby book and prove how excited we were to know our child was on the way. Did Mara actually say those words, or were they just a trick of memory? Being so open requires a sort of innocence, a hope. No, more than a hope. A conviction that the world was safe, that people were good, that life was a gift and nothing moved except as a positive power. Bad things happened, attacks, violence, crimes. Yes, unfortunately they did. But they could always be explained and therefore, eventually, understood, so they wouldn't have to happen again. So the people who did them could be helped and could change. Those were Mara's beliefs. Or they had been, back in the days just before her picture appeared on the front page of every paper in Connecticut. She had been an only child. Her parents were dead. Perhaps that was why the whole country adopted her, searched for her, and grieved for her as they would have their own daughter, sister, or friend. The anniversary of her disappearance always brought a new flurry of stories. TV stations ran recaps of old video shots, endless loops of her smiling, waving, holding the yellow watering can, and wearing a pair of matching buttercup yellow rubber rain boots in the garden. Newspapers reran the story every June 21st, the anniversary of her disappearance, and the longest day of the year, to remind readers of what had captivated the country so many years ago now. On the first night of summer, adorable, 5-foot-nothing, pregnant as could be, Mara Jameson went out to water the garden. Whether she hitched a ride and changed her identity, walked into the hands of a brutal stranger, or was already dead at the hands of her husband, has never been known. Her body was never recovered. She was never seen again. No baby was ever born, or at least not with a mother named Mara Jameson listed on the birth certificate. The only clues were the yellow rain boots, left neatly standing next to the trickling hose. The articles were grave, somber, but oddly wistful. They added up to a life never lived, a mystery never solved. What could have happened that would make her stop watering the garden and walk away? Who could ever forget that smile? That smile that would never be smiled again. Chapter 1. Being retired had its pluses. For one thing, it was good to be ruled by the tide tables instead of department shifts and schedules. Patrick Murphy kept the small Hartford Current tide card tacked up by the chart table, but he barely needed it anymore. He swore his body was in sync with the ebb and flow of Silver Bay. He'd be pulled out of bed at the craziest hours, in the middle of the night, at slack tides, prime times to fish the reefs and shoals around the Stone Mill power plant. Stripers up and down the Connecticut shoreline didn't stand a chance. They hadn't for 2 years, 7 months, 3 weeks and 14 days since Patrick had retired at the age of 43. This was the life. This was really the life, he told himself. He had lost the house, but he had the boat, the truck. This was what people worked their whole lives for, to retire to the beach and fish the days away. He thought of Sandra, what she was missing. They had had a list of dreams they would share after he left the Connecticut State Police. Walk the beaches, try every new restaurant in the area, go to the movies, hit the casinos, take the boat out to Block Island and Martha's Vineyard. They were still young. They could have a blast. A blast, he thought. Now, instead of the fun he had thought they would have together, blast made him think of the divorce, with its many shocks and devastations, the terrible ways both lawyers had found to make a shambles of the couple they had once been. Fishing helped. So did the Yankees. They had snapped their losing streak and just kept on winning. Many the night Patrick combined the two, casting and drifting, listening to John Sterling and Charlie Steiner call the game, cheering for the Yanks to win another as he trolled for stripers, as his boat slipped east on the current. Other things pulled him out of his bunk, too. Dreams with dark tentacles. Bad men still on the run after Patrick's best waking efforts to catch them. A lost girl. Shocks and attacks and bone-rattling fears that gave new meaning to things that go bump in the night. Patrick would wake up with a pounding heart, thinking of how terrified she must have been. Whether she was murdered, dead and buried all these years, or whether something had happened to drive her from her house, her grandmother's rose garden, to some place so far away she had never been seen again. Her fear must have been terrible. That's the thing he could never get out of his mind. What fears had Mara Jameson felt? Even now, his imagination grabbed hold of that question and went wild. The case was 9 years old, right at the top of his unsolved pile. The paperwork had been his albatross, his constant companion. The case was the rock to Patrick Sisyphus, and he had never, not even after it promised to ruin his marriage, not even after it made good on that promise, not even now after retirement, never stopped pushing it up the hill. Mara's picture. It sat on his desk. He used to keep it right beside his bed to remind him of what he had to do when he got up. Look for the sweet girl with the heartbreak smile and the laughing eyes. Now, he didn't really need the picture. Her face was ingrained into his soul. He knew her expressions by heart, the way other men knew their wives, girlfriends, lovers. She'd be with him forever, he thought, climbing out of bed at 5:30 a.m. He had only the vaguest idea of what his dream had been. Something about blood spatter on the kitchen floor, the spidery neon blue patterns revealed by the blood-detecting luminol, trickles and drops, spelling, in Patrick's dream, the killer's name. But it was in Latin, and Patrick couldn't understand. Besides, who could prove she'd been killed when her body had never been found? He rubbed his eyes, started the coffee, then pulled on shorts and sweatshirt. The morning air felt chilly. A front had passed through last night, violent thunderstorms shaking the rafters, making Flora hide under the bed. The black lab rubbed up against him now, friendly, bright eyes flashing, knowing a boat ride was in their future. Heading up on deck, he breathed in the salt air. The morning star blazed in the eastern sky, where the just about rising sun painted the dark horizon with an orange glow. His 32-foot fishing boat, the probable cause, rocked in the current. After the divorce, he'd moved on board. Sandra had kept the house on Mill Lane. It had all worked out fine, except now the boatyard was going to be turned into condos. Pretty soon, all of New England would be one big townhouse village, complete with dock-o-miniums, and Patrick would have to shove off and find a new port. Hearing footsteps on the gravel, he peered into the boatyard. A shadow was coming across the sandy parking lot. Flora growled. Patrick patted her head, then went down below to get two mugs of coffee. By the time he was back on deck, he saw Flora wagging her tail, eyes on the man standing on the dock. Angelo Nazarena.
Don't tell me, Patrick said. You smelled the coffee.
Nah, Angelo said. I got up early and saw the paper. I figured you needed company so you wouldn't get drunk or do something really stupid. Longest day of the year is tomorrow, and the articles are starting already.
He held the Hartford Courant in one hand, but accepted the heavy blue mug in the other as he stepped aboard.
I don't drink anymore, Patrick said.
He wanted to read the story, but didn't at the same time.
As you well know. Besides, I'm not speaking to you. You're selling my dock.
Making millions in the bargain, Angelo chuckled. When my grandfather bought this land, it was considered crap. The wrong side of the railroad bridge, next to a swamp, stinking like clam flats. But he was smart enough to know waterfront is solid gold, and I'm cashing in. Good coffee.
Patrick didn't reply. He was staring at Mara's picture on the front page. It had been taken in her grandmother's rose garden, 10 miles from here, at her pretty silver shingled cottage at Hubbard's Point. The camera had caught the light in her eyes, the thrill, the joy, that secret she always seemed to be holding back. Patrick had the feeling he so often had, that if he leaned close enough, she'd whisper to him, tell him what he so desperately wanted to know.
These papers really get a lot of mileage out of nothing, Angelo said, shaking his head. The poor girl's been gone 9 years now. She's fish food. We all know that.
Your Sicilian lineage is showing.
She's gone, Patrick. She's dead, Angelo said sharply now.
He and Patrick had gone to school together, been altar boys at St. Agnes's together, been best man at each other's wedding. He and Patsy had introduced him to Sandra.
The husband did it, right?
I thought so, for a long time, Patrick said.
What was his name, though? He had a different last name from Mara.
His name is Edward Hunter. Mara had her own career. She kept her own name when she married him.
And now Patrick saw Edward Hunter's handsome, charm boy face, his stockbroker's quick, sharp smile, as wide and bright as Mara's, but without 1 ounce of her heart, soul, depth, integrity, authenticity, spark. As a state cop, Patrick had encountered smiles like Edward Hunter's thousands of times. The smiles of men pulled over for speeding on their way home from places they shouldn't have been. The smiles of men at the other end of a domestic violence call. Smiling men trying to convince the world they were better than the circumstances made them seem, and reminding Patrick that smile was really just slime, spelled sideways.
Everyone thought so, not just you. But the bastard didn't leave a body behind. So you can't try him, and it's time for you.
We could have tried to pull a Richard Crafts, Patrick said,
naming Connecticut's infamous killer convicted of murdering his wife, whose body was never found, on the basis of a few fragments of hair and bone discovered in a rented wood chipper.
But we didn't even have enough for that. I couldn't even find enough evidence for that.
Like I was saying, it's time you moved on.
Okay. Thanks,
Patrick said, his expression saying, why didn't I think of that? His Irish rising as he faced his friend Angelo, who had brought over the morning paper with Mara's face on the front page, who was about to sell his boat slip right out from under him. Flora had gone for a run around the still deserted parking lot, and now she leapt back aboard the boat.
What I mean is,
Angelo said, trying to find the words to fill the hole he'd opened up.
What you mean is, it's time I got a life, I know,
Patrick said, giving his old friend an old friend's glance. The kind of look that tells them they know you better than anyone, that you take their point, that they were right all along, when what you really want is to just shut them up and get them off your case.
Yeah, to be honest, that's what I mean, Angelo said,
chuckling with relief even as Patrick was folding up the newspaper and tossing it through the hatch, purportedly for disposal, but actually to save forever, as he saved all of Mara's pictures. Because, he thought as he started up the engine and Angelo cast off the lines, as they headed out to the fishing grounds, It was one of the ways he had found to keep her alive. That, and one other way. The whole world assumed that Mara Jameson and her unborn baby had died all those 9 years ago, and they still did. Patrick thought back to his Catholic childhood, that phrase in the creed. We believe in all that is seen and unseen. It was pretty much impossible to have faith in what you couldn't see, and the world hadn't seen Mara in over 9 years. Backing out of the slip, hitting the bow thrusters, he eased into the channel. The boat chuffed through the deepening water as gray herons watched silently from shadows along the green marshy shore. The rising sun shone through scrub oaks and white pines. Bursts of gold glittered on the water ahead. The dead never stayed hidden. The earth gave them up, one way or another. Patrick knew they were relentless in their need to be found. The Tibetan Book of the Dead described the hungry ghosts, tormented by unbearable heat, thirst, hunger, weariness, and fear. Their realm seemed familiar to Patrick. Having spent his career investigating homicides, he believed that the dead had their own emotions, that they haunted the living until they were found. And Mara had never been found. After all the work he'd done on her case, Patrick believed he would know, deep inside his own body, if she were dead. He felt Mara Jameson in his mind, his skin, his heart. He carried her with him every day, and he knew he'd never be able to put her down until he knew for sure what had happened to her, where she was. The birds were working up ahead, marking a school of blues just before the Red Nun buoy. Angelo got the rods ready. Flora stood at Patrick's side, her body pressed against his leg as he hit the throttle and sped toward the fish, and tried in vain to escape the thoughts that haunted him wherever he went. And he knew that when he got back, he'd be ready to write her this year's letter. Ah, it was about to start again, as it did every year at this time. Just as the last traces of New England's long chill were gone from the air, just as the birds had returned north from their winter's journeys, just as the roses were coming into bloom and the gardens were awash with color, just as summer solstice was upon them with its gift of the longest day. The time had come around again. Maeve Johnson stood in her garden pruning. She wore a wide straw hat, white linen shirt, and hot pink garden gloves. In spite of all the cover-ups, she also wore sunscreen. They hadn't known about sun damage when she was a girl. They had all thought the sun was the great healing force. The more of it, the better. But she'd had a small skin cancer removed from her cheek last year and was determined to do her best to keep it from happening again, to stay as healthy as she could, to stay alive until she knew the entire truth. She had always been fastidious about putting lotion on her granddaughter. Mara had had such fair skin, so typically Irish, pale and freckled. Her parents, Mara's, that is, had been killed in a freak ferry accident on a trip to Mara's mother's hometown in the west of Ireland. Maeve had taken over raising their daughter, their only child. Every time she'd ever looked at Mara, she'd seen her son, Billy, and she loved her so much, more than the stars in the sky, more than anything, because she was a direct link to her darling boy. And she'd dutifully put sunscreen all over her freckled skin before letting her go down to the beach. You have the soul of your father in your blue eyes, Maeve would say, spreading the lotion.
And my mother?
Yes, Anna too, Maeve would say, because she had loved her Irish daughter-in-law almost as if she'd been her own child. But the truth was, Mara had been all Billy to Maeve. Maeve couldn't help herself. So now she just stood in her garden, clipping the deadheads from the rose bushes. She tried to concentrate on finding the three-leaf sets, but she was distracted by the two news people standing out by the road. They had their cameras out, clicking away. Tomorrow, the anniversary of Mara's disappearance, the headlines would no doubt read, Grandmother still waiting after all these years. Or roses for Mara's remembrance. Or some other malarkey. The local newspeople had always made a cartoon of the situation, tried to boil everything down into an easily palatable story for their readers to understand, when no one knew the whole truth, except Mara. Edward had played his part in the terrible drama, and Maeve knew some segments, but only Mara knew it all. Only Mara had endured it. The state police detective had learned some of it. Patrick Murphy, another Hibernian, although not in the tradition of Irish cops that Maeve remembered from growing up in the south end of Hartford. Those fellows had been tough, all steel, no nonsense, and they'd seen the world in black and white. Everything was one way or another. Not Patrick. Patrick was different. Maeve had taught school for 50 years, and if she'd ever had Patrick Murphy in her class, she knew that she would never have pegged him to be a police officer. Not that he hadn't done a thorough investigation. If anyone could find Mara, Maeve knew it would be Patrick. But there was something in his makeup that reminded Maeve of Johnny Moore, an Irish poet she had once known. She had seen it the day he had come here to Maeve's house, held her hand as they sat in rockers on the porch, and told her about the blood they had found on Mara's kitchen floor. Maeve's heart had frozen. It really had. She had felt her heart freeze and constrict, felt the muscles shrink, pulling all her blood back from her face and hands so that her head had dropped down on her chest. And when she'd come to, just a second or two later, Patrick was kneeling in front of her, with tears in his eyes, because he was thinking the same thing she had so often feared would happen. That Mara was dead. The baby was dead. That Edward had killed them both. Maeve had only to think of the tears in Patrick Murphy's blue eyes to feel her heart twist now, again, as she snipped away at the tangled rose bushes. She knew that he would come by, sometime in the next week or so, to check on her. Maeve held the green plastic-handled garden shears in her pink-gloved hand, clipping her rose bushes, cutting far enough down, right to the place where new life in the form of tiny green leaves emerged from the stem. Her arthritis was acting up. She could almost feel the photographers wanting to ask her to go get the yellow boots and watering can, stage the yard as it had been that day 9 years ago tomorrow.
Hello, Maeve.
Looking up, she saw her neighbor and lifelong best friend, Clara Littlefield, coming through the side yard. Clara carried a wicker picnic basket overflowing with French bread, grapes, brie, saucisson, and a bottle of wine. Hi, Clara, Maeve said. The two women bumped straw hats as they kissed.
The roses look so beautiful this year, Clara said.
Thank you. Look at Mara's beach roses. They've really come into their own, haven't they?
They have, Clara said, and the two women admired the full bushes, lush with pink blooms, planted by Mara the year her parents drowned. So many years ago. Meant to cherish her parents' memory, and now they were all Maeve had of Mara herself. Maeve's eyes filled with tears, and she felt Clara's arm slip around her.
You brought us a picnic? Maeve asked.
Of course. I can't come to stay at your house without bringing food. It's like those sleepovers we had 60 years ago, when we'd take turns providing the s'mores.
The sleepovers continue, Maeve said, smiling. No matter how old we are.
Clara laughed, hugging her again, almost making Maeve forget the reason for this particular sleepover, this picnic. Every June for the last 8 years, Maeve's best friend had come over to stay, to spend the night before that day when Mara put down the green garden hose and yellow watering can, slipped off her yellow boots, and walked out of her grandmother's yard forever.
Forever was such a long time.
But, Maeve thought, holding Clara's hand as they walked into the kitchen to delve into the picnic basket, it went by just a little easier when you had a best friend by your side. Chapter 2 The two girls had missed the bus, so they walked home from school, kicking a pebble ahead of them on the bumpy road high above the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They took turns.
First, Jessica would give it a good smack with her sneaker, send it bouncing along. When they caught up to the stone, Rose would take her shot. In between kicks, they walked and talked.
"Favorite color," Rose said.
"Blue." "Favorite animal," Jessica said.
"Cats." "Favorite book?"
"The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe."
"Mine too,"
Rose laughed as she kicked the pebble and got air, sending it in a long arc down the middle of the road.
"Did you see that?"
"Okay, you get the gold medal," Jessica said. "Back to question time."
"We've played this before," Rose said. "We already know the answers to all the questions."
"Not all the questions," Jessica said mysteriously.
"We've only been friends since I moved here in April. I'll bet you don't even know where I'm from."
"Boston," Rose said.
"That's just what we tell people," Jessica said. She had a pretend scary look on her freckled face.
"But there are secrets that even my best friend won't know. Until she asks me."
Rose giggled. She and Jessica were almost 9, and it felt delicious to imagine that her new friend had deep, dark secrets. And to know that to find out about them, all she had to do was ask. Mulling that over, she walked in silence. Off to the left, the Gulf of St. Lawrence stretched on forever. It was very calm and bright blue, with just the finest of haze spread like a silk scarf over its surface. Rose knew when she saw haze like that, summer was almost here. She scanned the bay in search of Nanny. When summer came, so did Nanny. Jessica miskicked the pebble into the weeds, so she started over with a new one. Rose inched a little way down the bank to find the old stone. Something made her want to keep it, so she put it in her pocket. By the time she looked up, Jessica had disappeared around the bend. Rose skipped a few steps. When she broke into a run, her heart fluttered like a trapped bird.
"Don't you want to know?"
Jessica asked, dribbling the pebble the way she did a soccer ball on the field.
"Sure,"
Rose said.
"Then ask," Jessica teased.
"Go on, I'll give you a clue. Ask me my real name."
"I know it. It's Jessica Taylor."
"Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe Taylor is my stepfather's name. Or maybe we decided to name ourselves after James Taylor. We love his music."
"So do my mother and I."
"My real father saw him in a concert once, at Tanglewood."
"Your real father?" Rose asked.
She wanted to ask more, but something about the look on Jessica's face made her hold back. Stress pulled her eyes tight and made her jaw square. It only lasted a moment, was gone in a flash, but Rose had seen. The words, "your real father," slashed between them. Rose felt them in her heart like another trapped bird.
"The air sure is clean up here," Jessica said, changing the subject as they started walking again. "It's the reason we moved to Cape Hawk. So far from pollution and junk in the air. Or at least that's what my mother tells everyone. But maybe..."
"Maybe what?" Rose asked.
"Maybe the real reason we moved here is another scary secret," Jessica said.
She tugged on one of Rose's braids, then pointed up at the mansion on the hill. Deer tracks led through the thick brush into the pine forest surrounding the great big stone house where the oceanographer lived.
"Let's go up there and spy on Captain Hook."
"I don't think that's such a good idea," Rose said, feeling the strange flutter again. "Considering he's our friend, and my mother has her store right next to his office."
"Yes, but that's way down at the dock," Jessica said. "She probably has no idea what goes on inside his big, crazy house. What if he's a mad scientist, and we have to save her? What if he's a real pirate with a name like Captain Hook?"
"His name is Dr. Neil," Rose said.
She knew the kids called him Captain Hook, but she never did. Rose knew that people were different, in all sorts of ways. She loved the things she and Dr. Neil had in common, and it made her sad when kids made fun of him. He was so tall and quiet, with that dark hair and deep-set eyes, and a thin mouth that never smiled, except when he was near Rose and her mother.
"I feel bad that your mother's beautiful shop has to be right next door to him," Jessica said. "Any one-armed guy who spends his life chasing sharks?" She shivered. when the rest of his family is so nice with their whale watch boats.
My birthday party is going to be a whale watch, Rose said.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?